Welcome, Northgate. This is an empty room that I'm now preaching this sermon back into on Sunday. Those of you who weren't here, who are probably the ones listening to this podcast, wouldn't have known, but we had a power outage that fried our recording elements. You'd have to talk to Jesse about what exactly that was, but because of that, we didn't get the sermon, and so we've decided that's important enough to make sure that we don't miss this this sermon in the grander scheme of things, in the trajectory that we're going. So I'm currently preaching it to an empty room with just Jesse and Dorothy in the opposite room. It's weird because I've already preached this once, so just embrace that. We've been wrapping up, or last Sunday we wrapped up a series on what I called it Generactions, which was looking at these different generations that we have represented in our church context and really in the workforce as well. This is the first time that we've had four generations kind of alive and well in American history, and we really have five because we have young children who are also up and about. And because of that, we have different desires, different perspectives, different hopes and dreams, different understandings of just about everything because we've been at this, some people for 90 years, some people for nine. So how do we make these all work together in one church or one business or even in a family? And so what we've done these past 4 weeks is heard from each of these different representatives, some of the traditionalists. We kind of got to hear their heart. We got to hear a panel from the boomers as well, and we got to hear their heart. And then 2 weeks ago, I talked about Gen X. Last week, Nick talked about millennials, and that's all well and good, but if we don't kind of say why we're talking about this, we kind of swing and miss into the value. So I want to start with a piece of scripture, which is one of my favorites. It comes from Hebrews 12, the verses 1 to 2, which really just kind of focus our conversation for the rest of our time. It says, "So then, let's also run the race that is laid out in front of us, since we have such a great cloud of witnesses surrounding us. Let's throw off any extra baggage, get rid of the sin that trips us up, and fix our eyes on Jesus, faith's pioneer and perfecter. He endured the cross, ignoring the shame for the sake of the joy that was laid out in front of him, and sat down at the right hand of God." And so when we look at this verse, I remember when I first kind of spent any time with this, there was a seminary professor who really talked about that cloud of witnesses that are surrounding us, really being those brothers and sisters, those mothers and fathers of the faith that have either gone before us or, I said on Sunday, look around, the people in this room are that cloud of witnesses. It's really depressing to use that line here because there's nobody here. But it's really this idea that we have all these people who really want the same thing for us. They want to see our lives transformed by Jesus. They want us to run the race with vigor and with zeal. And so all of us really are cheering one another on. We're just not exactly sure what we're cheering each other to. So I want us to keep that idea of Jesus kind of running to the cross with joy, not because he was excited to be crucified, but because he was excited about what happens on the other side, that he gets to reunite all of our hearts and our faces and our spirits with his Father, and that's sort of his motivation. So from there, we talked a little bit about just a brief summary of each of the different generations. If you're listening in podcast world, you can actually just go back and listen to the previous ones. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but let's just admit the fact that traditionalists want something different than boomers, who want something different from Gen X, who want something very different than millennials. I've just been watching, since the sermon, I've been watching a documentary from CNN on the 80s and the 90s, and you look at the music and how it speaks for each of these different generations, and it's saying wildly different things. If you grew up in the 70s and you loved James Taylor, you may not love Kurt Cobain, but if you grew up in the 90s, you probably dig Nirvana because it kind of speaks what your angst is. It kind of speaks the things that are on your mind. So we see all these different things in music, in art, in culture, in elections, in all these different areas that have manifested themselves in even the way we individually think. So that question is, how do we process this? What do we do with five generations of people who want five different things? The first answer that I gave was not superficial, but kind of just very, very practical, pragmatic. It comes from Hayden Shaw's book called Sticking Points, where he goes through these 13 different areas that are areas of conflict within the church and within business based on these generations, things like dress code, those sorts of things. What do you do with technology? And he says these are the five things that you do to make it a livable situation and even one that flourishes. He says, first, you have to acknowledge that there are differences. And that's kind of what we've been doing for the last 4 weeks. We've listened to the traditionalists represent the traditionalists. That's why I didn't do it, because I wanted us to hear from them. We heard the boomers talk about the boomers and so on. So we have to understand, yes, they're different, and I think that's what we've done so far. Secondly, he says you have to appreciate those differences. You have to not just recognize that they are there, but you have to say, no, I see why the traditionalists are hyper-loyal. I understand why they're patriotic. I understand why they like order and structure. Doesn't mean you believe all those same things, but you at least know how they got there, and you appreciate the benefits to those things, to those perspectives. Thirdly, he says that we have to be willing to flex, kind of compromise a little bit on how we're going to live out those perspectives and those desires. Fourthly, he says to leverage the biggest strengths from each of those. And then fifth, he says you have to decide something. You have to make a resolution. You have to not just allow the situation to come to you, but you have to, if you're running a business, you can't just let traditionalists and millennials yell at each other all the time. You have to do something. So what do you do? Those are all the kind of pragmatic things. They're helpful, but then in a separate book, Hayden Shaw talks about these next three choices that I'll give us. And on Sunday, used Prague's Overwhelming Athleticism to illustrate this point. I had a bucket, and I gave him four balls and said, throw these four balls into one bucket. And he was 3 of 4. It was actually pretty good. And then I spread those four buckets out, each of those buckets representing one of the generations that we might be trying to please, that we might be trying to serve, that would be our target and our audience. And I said, now, all at once, throw those four balls into the four targets, and he failed miserably. Not because he did anything wrong. It's just really hard to hit four targets if they're all, if you're trying to shoot at all of them at once. And so that was an illustration of the fact that if we are a church that wants to still be vibrant and full of zeal, be able to impact the community that we live in, we kind of have to decide, right? Who are we here to serve? Now, on Sunday, I gave us a little prep time to say, hey, this is a hard question. Let's prep ourselves for this question, because it can be stressful. But what I want to make sure we understand is that it has to be answered one way or the other. Before I talk about what those questions are, the three choices we have, I wanted to make sure that nothing that I say sounds like it's exclusionary language, right? That we're not doing anything to dishonor the other generations. We're not going to leave anybody behind. This doesn't mean that we're going to stop caring about the old people or stop caring about the young people. No, we're a family. You still care about your crazy uncle and your annoying niece, right? You love the good news too. And the choices are this. One, we can stay old or stay the same and kind of grow old together. And I said on Sunday, and I mean it today, there's great nobility in that to say, these are the people who have been here forever. We want to honor them. We want to celebrate the decisions and the sacrifices that they've made to make this church what it is today. We want to work with them. We want to love on them. We want to celebrate them. And we want to maybe even attract other folks like them to Northgate. It's a little trickier to bring in boomers and traditionalists, because generally if you're 60 or 80 and you haven't yet found a church, there's probably a reason, right? Most church growth doesn't come from 60 and 80-year-olds. If it does, it's transitional growth, and it's somebody from the church across the street who happens to be angry and comes over. So if we want to be a church that grows and we want to be a church that continues to have impact in the community, this one might not be the greatest option. This is the one that we would use to kind of sustain. And we have to recognize that there are life cycles to all of these things, right, to trees. Now, you go to big trees, like an hour and a half north of here, and you see these trees that are 3,500 years old, but they die. They live a really, really long time, but eventually trees die. People die, institutions die, governments die, churches sometimes die. And if we were to continue to just stay the same and grow old, that's on the forefront, but that isn't, that's not a blemish on our legacy or anything. That's just a truth that things come and go. We read this in Ecclesiastes and bunches of places. The second option is the exact opposite, which is to skew younger, right? To say, no, we are going to be a church that is about attracting and collecting those last generations that we spoke about, the millennials and the Gen Xers, who are more or less they are the least churched groups in the States. They're leaving, and you can get conflicting numbers on this, but some of the terrifying numbers are that millennials are just, they're running out in droves. And if you listen to Nick the other day, he kind of said that they're not necessarily leaving the church, they're kind of leaving the institutional church, but they're still very, very, very interested in who Jesus is, and they're very interested in spiritual things. They just haven't seen a model that speaks to them in a way that is compelling and attractive. And so if we are a church that wants to attract those folks, well, that means we have to do things differently. We play less James Taylor and more Justin Bieber, neither of which will actually happen on my watch, I promise. The third option, which is what the bucket illustration tried to show, is that if we just try to do both, if we try to make the traditionalists and the boomers and the Xers and the millennials happy, we will end up missing all of those targets, and we are just kind of complacently waiting for circumstances to come and get us instead of going and being proactive and intentional. And this is where we transitioned into some scriptures where I say this is not what we see Jesus model, and you can look through the epistles and see the same thing with Paul. But I started with the story in Mark 1, 28 through 38, and I'll read that now. So first chapter of Mark, it says, "After leaving the synagogue, Jesus, James, and John went home with Simon and Andrew. Simon's mother-in-law was in bed, sick with a fever, and they told Jesus about her at once. He went up to her, took her by the hand, and raised her up. The fever left her, and she served them. That evening, at sunset, people brought to Jesus those who were sick or demon-possessed. The whole town gathered near the door. He healed many who were sick with all kinds of diseases, and he threw out many demons, but he didn't let the demons speak because they recognized him. Early in the morning, well before sunrise, Jesus rose and went to the deserted place, where he could be alone in prayer. Simon and those with him tracked him down. When they found him, they told him, 'Everyone's looking for you.'" So just last night, Jesus was doing all the cool things, right? All the charismatic kind of stuff. Healing people, casting out demons, making blind people see. It was a good day. It's the kind of thing that really charges a lot of people in ministry. Like if I could last night have spent the night just healing people and casting out demons, I'd be terrified. But I'd also be really excited about the fact that that's the ministry that I got to do. And what's he say the next day? They say, "Everyone's looking for you." And Jesus says, "Let's head in the other direction to the nearby villages so that I can preach to those as well. That is why I've come." And so you see Jesus really making a decision between what's already existent and something new, right? He chooses, now that's not at the exclusion, it's not like he doesn't love the people that he just healed, he loves them, he served them, he ministered to them in very powerful ways, but it's just a time for a different direction. He goes in the other direction. We see a similar story in Matthew 10, verses 11 to 14. This is just as Jesus is sending out the 12 disciples, and it's a very similar story when he sends out the 72. But starting in Matt 10:11, it says, "Whatever city or village you go into, find somebody in it who is worthy and stay there until you go on your way. When you go into a house, say, 'Peace.' If the house is worthy, give it your blessing of peace. But if the house isn't worthy, take back your blessing. If anyone refuses to welcome you or listen to your words, shake off the dust of your feet as you leave that house or city." Once again, Jesus is telling his disciples, be decisive, make a decision. Don't allow circumstances to just come to you and just serve whoever happens to come in. This is not to bang on the old church model, but this is really kind of how the church worked the last 50 years, is if we have a really good show, if we have a really compelling teacher, if we have a really good music, people will come to us. And all the research and all the studies and all the books that you read say that's just not true anymore. We kind of have to go to them. So we have to make decisions. Who are we going to serve? And then I read, and I won't do it here, but I read John chapter 11, verses 1 to 46, which was the entirety of the Lazarus story. But let me just summarize it this way. Jesus is called away, or is called while he's away, by Martha and Mary and Lazarus. They say to Jesus, "Your friend Lazarus is dying." And Jesus says, "I'm going to hang tight here. Wherever he's ministering, he's not interested in leaving right then. And the disciples that are with him are a little confused by this. And he ends up, after 4 days, he ends up going back to serve Lazarus, Mary, and Martha. These are some of his dearest friends. And he has chosen not to serve them initially because he says in verse 15, "I'm glad for you that I wasn't there so that you may believe." This is just after he has told the disciples that Lazarus has died. Now, that's real confusing to them. But then he goes on, and the story unfolds, and he goes and he meets with Mary, and he meets with Martha, and they're sobbing. And then Jesus, you know, in verse 35, he's weeping. He's been sort of deeply troubled in his spirit. Then he goes in, and he approaches the tomb, and he says, "Move the stone." And they say, "Dude, he's going to stink." And he says, "That's fine. Have you not listened to the things I said?" They roll the stone back, and he speaks for Lazarus to come from the dead. And he goes hobbling out with his hands and feet tied and his face covered. So Jesus, again, has to make a decision. And this one's real weird, right? He decides not to go to his best friend, not to minister to the people that he loves most deeply, but to stay where he was. And so we see kind of a precedent in both of these for staying and for going. But it is interesting that after he chooses to stay where he is, he still comes. Now, he's Jesus, right? He has this overwhelming authority to not just in the Mark story cast out demons and heal, but here we see in John that he literally takes a dead man and raises him. And we're told that we have the same sort of power and the same sort of authority to do the things that Christ has done. In fact, to do better things because we have the Holy Spirit dwelling in us. And I just sometimes wonder if that's what the church is doing. Are we content to just do the things that we've done? And because we're content, are we missing these opportunities to do life-changing, radical things because it's scary? Or because it's just uncomfortable? Or because we have to make a decision, right? Sometimes we just don't want to make a decision. It's easier to just see what happens. Just let the circumstances come to us. And I just don't see Jesus as being passive really anywhere in Scripture. He's a pretty assertive, intentional, focused cat. So all of this leads to a discussion that we've had throughout these generational things, this question of what is legacy? And what do we want the legacy of Northgate to be? One of my early sermons here, I asked the question, if Northgate dissolved, would anybody notice? And would anybody care? And I don't know what the answer to that is yet, but that's not my job to answer. That's our job to answer. If we don't know what our legacy is, what do we want our legacy to be? Do we want to be the church that was 100 with the funny roof? Or do we want to be a church that has impact in our community? Do we want to be the church that, like Jesus, goes and heals, casts out demons, brings peace, allows joy and dignity and worth and self-value to return to people? That sounds more fun to me, but really it's a question that we have to answer, and we're going to answer this at least in part and at least formally at the November 18th congregational meeting. We'll have a little discussion about this. What church do we want to be? Again, there's honor in being the church that just grows old together, but there's also honor in the exact opposite, and if we try to do both, smart money says that we will do neither. So I end with this quote. It's attributed to George Washington, but I think that this is a great summary of what it is we ask of the church and of you who are Northgaters. George Washington is attributed with the saying, "I am a soldier, so my son can be a shopkeeper, and so his son can be an artist." Being a soldier is really, really hard. Being a shopkeeper is pretty hard. Being an artist is hard, but in much more beautiful, kind of life-affirming, joy-seeking ways. We have a lot of folks here who have been soldiers for 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years. What I don't want us to do is to just be soldiers to be soldiers. I want us to be soldiers so that our kids can be shopkeepers. And I want our shopkeeper kids to be shopkeepers so that our kids can be artists. And so the question moving forward is kind of, are we going to be a church of soldiers? Are we going to be a church of shopkeepers? Or are we going to be a church of artists? And whatever we choose, how are we going to frame that in the discussion of who we are here to serve? Are we just doing the hard work to do the hard work? Are we just being a soldier? Or do we feel that we might be moving into a time where we can actually be creative, where we can actually sort of express joy, where we can do the things that artists do to attract the people who are hungry for that meaning and value? So again, I hope this question is a little haunting. What and who are we about? This isn't a question that I think we can just flippantly answer, and it's not one that I think we can easily dismiss. I think it's a question that we have to not talk about our preferences, not ask really what we want, but if this really is Jesus' church, we have to ask him what it is that he wants.